The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the book section of the December 30th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker. Does morality do us any good? Our basic sense of right and wrong appears to be the product of blind evolution. The hard question is how unsettling that should be. By Nikhil Krishnan. Nothing kills your appetite, they say, like discovering how the sausage is made. In the realm of superhero cinema, origin stories explain our protagonist's driving motivations. But in the realm of faith and values, I stopped believing everything the tabloids said after I went on a school trip to the offices of my local paper. Others have grown disillusioned once they scrutinize the early history of their religion as historians, not as adherents. It's harder to keep believing some things once you find out why you believe them. Naturally, I hold slavery to be an abomination and liberal democracies to be better than totalitarian dictatorships. But why? I could draw on my years of education to tell you it has something to do with my belief in freedom, autonomy, the awfulness of treating a fellow human being as a mere instrument. But a skeptic can point out that I had these convictions before I was ever in a position to articulate a cogent argument for them. The arguments came afterward. They are rationalizations of things I already believed. The unflattering truth, the skeptic might continue, is that my views on slavery simply reflect the moral common sense of the society I was born into. My affection for liberal democracy may come from the simple fact that I grew up in one, surrounded by its propaganda. Who knows what I'd think if I'd been raised as a member of a plantation-owning family in the antebellum South, where abolitionists were regarded as dangerous eccentrics. I used to fancy myself a rational creature who believed things for reasons. Now, attuned to the question of origins, I see myself as no freer of the nexus of causes than my dog, my cactus, or my tennis ball. And not only me. We can all be viewed as the culmination of history, physics, and biology. Yes, our beliefs about math and the natural sciences are products of a history just as much as our moral beliefs are. But happily, we have something with which to assess our scientific beliefs. There are lab tests to determine whether Newton's first law holds. The trouble is that there's nothing we can test our moral convictions against, except perhaps other moral convictions, our own and those of other people. Of course, I think my moral convictions are the right ones. That's why they're my convictions. Maybe all I'm entitled to say, though, is that they happen to be mine, as my tastes happen to be mine. A different childhood, different genes, and you'd find a man with the views of John C. Calhoun instead. When the German philosopher Hanno Sauer titled his ambitious new book The Invention of Good and Evil, A World History of Morality, published by Oxford, he made it clear that he sees morality as quite different from science. In his account, morality, that body of judgments about good and evil, the practices that reflect those judgments, and the blame, guilt, and punishment that sustain them, hasn't always existed. That's why it had to be invented rather than discovered. For Sauer, the story of the invention of morality is really the story of the evolution of humanity. The processes that produced our morality are simply the processes that produced us as beings who have this morality, rather than, say, the norms that govern ants in their caste-bound colony, or wolves in their packs, or the snow leopard in its solitude. To understand ourselves as moral creatures, we have to understand that were built that way. And who exactly are we in all this? The question can be answered in several ways. We might simply be all human beings, members of the species Homo sapiens, or something much narrower, human beings in the 21st century West, with all the values and behavioral quirks peculiar to us, or something in the middle, human beings in a certain stage of a journey that began a few million years ago, shaped by some combination of physics, biochemistry, neurobiology, and history. The structure of Sauer's book reflects this ambiguity, dividing itself into sections that focus on distinct stages of human evolution as he draws on research, some of it now well known, from evolutionary biology, game theory, neuroscience, behavioral psychology, and big picture history of the sort done by writers such as Jared Diamond, David Graeber, and Yuval Noah Harari. Sauer isn't the first writer to embark on an ambitious genealogy of morality. The example of Friedrich Nietzsche, the author of the most ambitious such work, makes one expect something similarly dark and unsettling. Curiously, Sauer's tour of the sausage factory, far from leaving him stricken with nausea, seems to have whetted his appetite for the product. To understand why, we might as well follow his example and start at the very beginning. It was 5 million years ago, Sauer tells us, that creatures rather like ourselves, having only just evolved from some now extinct ape, started to develop the psychological dispositions that made them capable of cooperation. Unlike the chimpanzees and bonobos of the dense forests around Central Africa, our ancestors had to survive in exposed grasslands. Cooperating for mutual defense against our predators and for collectively pursuing prey was our way of compensating for our new vulnerability. Among the dispositions that emerged to help us get along, Sauer writes, was the capacity for altruistic behavior, putting aside the interests of the individual in favor of a greater common good. Sauer enlists a thought experiment proposed by the American anthropologist Sarah Blaffer Hardy to bring out the distinctiveness of the human capacity for cooperating. Compare how human beings typically behave when flying, crammed together among strangers, silent and motionless, with how chimpanzees might act in the same condition. There'd be pools of blood on the carpet, torn ears, fingers and penises, countless dead apes throughout the plain, and great howling and gnashing of teeth, Sauer writes. None of this tells us that non-human apes can't cooperate. It does suggest, Sauer continues, that we may be unique in how we do it, more flexibly, more generously, with more discipline, and with less suspicion, even with strangers. As our environments changed 500,000 or so years ago, and our groups grew larger, we developed the useful new practice of punishment. In evolutionary terms, this was enormously significant. A species that kills its most belligerent, aggressive, and ruthless members over hundreds of generations creates a strong selection pressure in favor of peacefulness, tolerance, and impulse control, Sauer argues. We are the descendants of the friendliest. These friendly apes were not so friendly that they gave up on their newly acquired punitive psychology. They had some version of sentiments and customs we still recognize, blame and shame. But they also began to develop habits of trust and mistrust that enabled them to make good use of information and skills bequeathed by previous generations. So far, things were relatively egalitarian. Then, 5,000 or so years ago, after agriculture spread and prehistory gave way to history, hierarchies emerged, dividing our societies into groups, the socioeconomic elites, and everyone else. As things became more unequal, we developed a paradoxical aversion to inequality. In time, patterns began to appear that are still with us. Kinship and hierarchy were replaced or augmented by cooperative relationships that individuals entered into voluntarily, covenants, promises, and the economically essential contracts. The people of Europe, at any rate, became what Joseph Heinrich, the Harvard evolutionary biologist and anthropologist, influentially termed weird. W-E-I-R-D, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. W-E-I-R-D people tend to believe in moral rules that apply to every human being, and tend to downplay the moral significance of their social communities or personal relations. They are, moreover, much less inclined to conform to social norms than lack a moral valence, or to defer to such social judgments as shame and honor, but much more inclined to be bothered by their own guilty consciences. That brings us to the past 50 years, decades that inherited the familiar structures of modernity, capitalism, liberal democracy, and the critics of these institutions, who often fault them for failing to deliver on the ideal of human equality. The civil rights struggles of these decades have had an urgency and an excitement that, Sauer writes, make their supporters think victory will be both quick and lasting. When it is neither, disappointment produces the identity politics that is supposed to be the essence of the present cultural moment. His final chapter, billed as an account of the past 5 years, connects disparate contemporary phenomena, vigilance about microaggressions and cultural appropriation, policies of no platforming, as instances of the punitive psychology of our early homonym ancestors. Our new sensitivities, along with the 21st century terms they have inspired, mansplaining, gaslighting, guide us as we begin to scrutinize the symbolic markers of our group membership more and more closely, and to penalize any noncompliance. We may have new targets, Sauer says, but the psychology is an old one. Sauer, who cautions that his chronological arrangements shouldn't be taken too literally, terms the results of his multidisciplinary triangulation a deep history, one that doesn't use dates or names, sketching out instead a feasible scenario that could have gone along these lines. But his approach does lead him to conclude that there are universal moral values that all people share with each other. Thinkers who see morality as having been constructed are often supposed to have trouble accounting for the possibility of moral progress. What is progress, after all, if not swapping error for a timeless truth? The anxiety induced in us by genealogical reflection comes, in large part, from having to accept that what we'd taken to be an eternal verity might be a fairly recent product of human history, biological and social. If our moral commitments do not rest on deeper truths, how can we hope to resolve the conflicts that continue to divide us? Sauer's perspective here is notably sunny. He sees a possible future in which our values do not so much converge as reveal themselves never to have really diverged in the first place. In reality, it is simply not true that at the most fundamental level, different cultures have different values, he argues. Widely shared values, as revealed by the World Values Survey, include personal safety and freedom, care and tolerance, happiness, autonomy, and self-fulfillment. Distracted by our seeming divisions, he writes, we can forget the fundamentals. We all share the same history of morality. Our political disagreements are often shallow, Underneath them are deep-seated universal moral values that all people share with each other. And that can be the basis for a new understanding. Can such optimism be justified? Other genealogists of morals, notably Nietzsche, doubted that moral beliefs could long retain their grip after we'd learn how they arose. Nietzsche's genealogy, needless to say, was a more impressionistic affair and did not reach back to any evolutionary savanna. Instead, he was interested in the shift from the values of antiquity, focused on things like heroism, worldliness, power, to those of the Christian early Middle Ages, focused on humility, renunciation, compassion, and sin. For Nietzsche, this shift was almost entirely to be deplored. The older ethics, a master morality, had been replaced by something, a slave morality, motivated principally by the hatred, resentment, self-assertion, and wishful thinking of the slaves who sought to transform the necessities of their situation into virtues. It's no surprise that the meek of the world were drawn to a philosophy that promised them they would inherit the earth. If Nietzsche was right, altruism comes from selfishness, humility from arrogance, love from hate. And the success of the moralization process was to be found in the fact that it made these tawdry underpinnings invisible. Exposing these origins, in turn, was bound to sap our faith in the modern ideology of good and evil. The question is whether the pedigree that Sauer lays out will prove less discomfiting. In the cold light of day, he asks, will the uncomfortable truth shatter our confidence in our values? Will it show that our morality can stand up to closer scrutiny? He plainly thinks that it can, or at least that quite a lot of our morality will survive, and indeed, that understanding its origins may actually strengthen our confidence in it. In taking this attitude, he disclaims the hyperbolic polemics that are part of Nietzsche's own entertaining but bad habits, and chooses instead the optimism of a very different thinker, the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Take an institution that demands absolute allegiance to its laws, such as the nation state. People throughout history, especially those who have been the targets of state violence, have wondered whether we owe this entity our allegiance at all. One way to answer the question, why obey the law, is to explain why the law exists in the first place. To address the question, what's it for, Hume saw that the question could be asked with equal force about the moral law. It was perfectly reasonable to inquire after the point of it, to try to figure out its function. But unlike Nietzsche, he thought that doing so was unlikely to turn us against it. Hume's strategy was to invite us to imagine a world before morality, or specifically, before human beings came to value such qualities as justice or to care much for property rights. We were to suppose that human beings in these very ancient times had a basic psychology much like ours, self-interested but capable of sympathy, and needs much like ours, to be fed, housed, and protected from random violence. Should we be surprised that they would have come up with something like the concept of justice, that is to say, principles setting out who owes what to whom? Surely it was only natural that they would count it a good thing if you were the sort of person who told the truth, kept your promises, paid your debts, did not take other people's stuff without asking, and did your share of the dishes. One might say that the concept of morality here is a construction, or that, as Hume put it, the virtue is artificial. But so what? Artificial doesn't mean unreal or without authority. The rules of morality, even as Hume conceived of them, are no less real or authoritative than other things we also have made up. Traffic lights, norms of etiquette, the principles of grammar. Discovering that the rules in question are there for a reason, far from shattering our respect for their authority, may serve to reinforce it. Stories like Sauer's are inheritors of Hume's confidence. The point of these evolutionary narratives is not to show morality to be in any serious way problematic. It is to show that morality has a function. Sauer, accordingly, enlists the evolutionary history of morality on behalf of what, in much of the 20th century, seemed a quaint and outmoded notion, moral progress. There seems to be mechanisms between the generations that have the potential gradually to improve human morality, he writes. Progress is always possible and often tangible. Sauer wrote his book in German. Joe Heinrich's English translation preserves the deadpan quality of the prose, but it is not in any stereotypical way Germanic. Much of the book's bibliography consists of works in English, and the books he cites as authoritative are nearly all recent works in psychology and the social sciences. He finds little to interest him in imaginative literature or theology. Sauer's optimism seems almost to be intended as a rebuke to the dour ideal of intellectual seriousness that runs from such canonical thinkers as Arthur Schopenhauer in the 19th century to Theodore Adorno in the 20th. Still, toward the end, he briefly entertains some challenges to his expectation of halting but reliable moral progress across the generations. The conditions in which our morality evolved, he notes, equip us well for cooperation with small groups. But how can we orchestrate cooperation on a scale that encompasses all of humanity and includes generations living far into the future? The challenge of climate change is one of several we face now that show that problem to be more than theoretical. His answer is equivocal and sits uneasily with the optimism that has preceded it. This is the first time we have faced this task. We do not know if we are capable of doing it. The note of uncertainty is welcome in a text marked by its confidence in cutting-edge evolutionary biology and social science. To be sure, the curtains are soon drawn on this less inspiring view. Sauer's tone of reassurance prevails, grounded in the thesis that our divisions rest on a more or less shared moral system. We would be wrong to worry that morality lacked foundations. The facts on which moral judgments depend are not themselves up to us. We cannot choose not to be social animals. Nor could we decide tomorrow to adopt the social structures and psychologies of the bumblebee or the Arctic fox. Although Sauer's picture of morality has no room for moral facts as God's laws, it finds another respect in which they might be objective nevertheless. The ethical facts are what they are because we are who we are. If some societies weigh our shared values differently, he says, that's because of socioeconomic differences, and not radically divergent morals. The same is true, he suggests, for polarization within societies. It's simply a matter of group identities assuming outsized importance. We don't disagree. We just hate each other. Given the basic psychological structures we've all inherited, he contends, there is an underestimated potential for reconciliation that is hard for us to see, but which may be sustained by a silent majority of reasonable people who reject the ideological extremes. The book ends with a vision of feverish discord and hatred replaced by a feast of calm and community. Evidently, we can put aside our superficial moral differences and reach these sunlit uplands by reminding ourselves of how we came to have the values we have. Will the story do the trick? Several ancient epics would be a lot shorter if all it took to reconcile the feuding brothers was a reminder of their shared lineage. Unfortunately, our origin stories don't tell us how to resolve any particular ethical dispute. The essence of such disputes, as with the fratricidal wars of the ancients, is that they are between factions who share the same psychology, the same history, the same aspirations. The history that made us into creatures capable of cooperation also gave us the capacity to hate one another in the aggregate, to draw sharp lines dividing the in-group from the out-group. Sauer's book may cast a gloomier light than he acknowledges. Our capacity for endless conflict may be just as much a part of our inheritance as is our ability, every now and then, to get along. In Sauer's final chapter, which deals with the moral or moralistic developments of the past 5 years, one can find some reasons for pessimism. In the standard picture of moral progress, popularized by the philosophers such as Peter Singer, morality advances when we expand the circle of our concern beyond the narrow original in-group of family or clan. The welfare of human beings from other tribes and nations starts to count, too. We even begin to extend our moral concerns beyond the human, newly troubled at the thought of factory farms that made possible the cheap burgers on which we once cheerfully gorged. Yet, that vaunted expansion itself creates a new outgroup, the deplorables who, say, persist in voting against greater immigration or who won't sit quietly and eat their tofu. In other words, we learn to define the outgroup, the people we don't have to care about, rather like the orcs in a fantasy video game, by its moral failings. The in-group is diverse in terms of race and gender, but morally homogeneous. It wasn't so long ago that American progressives on social media, weighing in on the hashtag pandemic of the unvaccinated, would occasionally betray a grim sense of satisfaction that the Red County orcs were getting their comeuppance. Does that mean that real moral progress can come only if we give up on moralism? That's too easy. When the much-derided moralism of our time relaxes, the newly emancipated deplorables will focus their ire on the do-gooders of the previous generation, their detested outgroup. Some visions of moral progress look forward to a world in which the in-group, out-group distinction has vanished. The real lesson of Sauer's genealogy may be that we're just not built that way. Next, from the New Yorker's review of Cultural Milestones of 2024, the Gilded Age of Medicine is here. Health insurers and hospitals increasingly treat patients less as humans in need of care than consumers who generate profit, by Dhruv Kular. In 2010, a private equity firm called Cerberus Capital Management, which is named for the three-headed dog that is said to guard the underworld, bought 6 Catholic hospitals in Massachusetts and christened the chain Steward Healthcare. The state's attorney general blessed the deal on multiple conditions, including that during a 5-year review period, the hospitals stayed open and their workers stayed employed. A few months after the period ended, however, Steward started selling the land on which the hospital stood. A $1.25 billion deal in 2016 helped to finance more acquisitions. Many facilities, asked to pay rent on land they had previously owned, struggled. According to a recent report published by Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey's office, which covers the period between 2017 and 2024, some Steward facilities had to forego key investments in staffing, surgical equipment, elevator repairs, and even clean linens. Patients increasingly languished in emergency rooms, many left without receiving care, and mortality rates for common conditions climbed sharply. Stewart has argued that its death rates were better than expected, given the underlying health status of the patients it cared for. A hospital in Florida developed a bat infestation, and another in Texas was cited for placing potentially suicidal patients in rooms with materials with which they could hang themselves. Employees at Stewart's Kearney Hospital in Massachusetts began calling their workplace Carnage Hospital. Cerberus's ownership ended in 2020, and the firm claims that the quality issues at Stewart are overwhelmingly related to the post-Cerberus ownership period. In May, Stewart filed for bankruptcy. It has closed 2 hospitals and plans to sell 31 others. Stewart's CEO, Ralph De La Torre, who in 2011 purchased a $40 million superyacht and was subpoenaed by a Senate committee but failed to show up. He was held in contempt of Congress and resigned from his position. De La Torre, in turn, sued the committee for violating his right against self-incrimination. Nonetheless, Cerberus realized a profit of $790 million from its investment in Stewart. Meanwhile, in some places in the United States, private equity firms now own more than half of all medical practices within certain specialties. "We are being picked clean by private equity," a New Jersey-based radiologist said at a recent meeting of the American Medical Association. "There are people who don't know where their next paycheck is even going to come from because their groups have been flipped so often." 2024 was arguably the year that the mortal dangers of corporate medicine finally became undeniable and inescapable. A study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, found that after hospitals were acquired by private equity firms, Medicare patients were more likely to suffer falls and contract bloodstream infections. Another study found that if private equity acquired a nursing home, its residents became 11% more likely to die. Although private equity firms often argue that they infuse hospitals with capital, a recent analysis found that hospital assets tend to decrease after acquisition. Yet, private equity now oversees nearly a third of staffing in U.S. emergency departments and owns more than 450 hospitals. In some of them, patients were forced to sleep in hallways, and doctors who spoke out were threatened with termination, according to Jonathan Jones, a former president of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. Aaron Fuse Brown, a professor at the Brown University School of Public Health, told me that private equity firms have learned that they don't have to make things better or make them more efficient. You can just change one small thing and make a ton more money. They are hardly the only corporations to learn this lesson. Increasingly, health insurers, private hospitals, and even nonprofits are behaving as though they aim first to extract revenue and only second to care for people. Patients often are viewed less as humans in need of care than consumers who generate profit. In 1873, Mark Twain co-wrote the novel The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today, which satirized an era that was marked by inequality, greed, and moral decay, but was painted in a veneer of abundance and progress. Industrialists made fortunes in oil, steel, and shipping, even as millions suffered poverty and exploitation. Today, healthcare is where the money is. New technologies and treatments sustain the impression that patients have never been healthier. But corporations and conglomerates wield immense power at the expense of the people they're meant to serve. Welcome to the Gilded Age of Medicine. In recent years, healthcare corporations have embraced an approach that can only be described as gamification. In the U.S., all seniors over 65 are entitled to health insurance through Medicare, and for several decades, private companies have offered plans through programs such as Medicare Advantage. The government pays insurance companies a fixed sum based partly on how sick those patients are. The sicker the patients, the bigger the potential payments. But who's to say, really, how sick a patient is? Let the games begin. This year, the health news site Stat revealed that UnitedHealth, the country's largest private insurer, had set up dashboards for practices to compete on how many conditions they could diagnose in patients. Doctors who completed the most appointments with seniors in Medicare Advantage were eligible for $10,000 bonuses, and patients were offered $75 gift cards for getting checkups at which their medical histories could be recorded. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, an email sent to one practice told clinicians that documenting chronic illnesses was the number one priority. Insurance companies have even started to scour medical records for possible diagnoses and to send nurses to patients' homes to perform health risk assessments. These strategies rack up so many additional diagnoses that in 2023 alone, the federal government made $7.5 billion in overpayments to insurers, according to the U.S. Office of the Inspector General. Insurers are pouring tremendous resources into developing the capacity to code patients in a way that nets more money for Medicare. Donald Berwick, a former head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, told me, "That's taxpayer money being siphoned away from people who need it." Berwick said that his own physician's practice had recently been acquired by UnitedHealth. One day he asked his doctor, "Anything different now?" "Two things," the doctor replied. "I have to see more patients each day, and my patients have new diagnoses that I didn't put there." Many patients with atrial fibrillation, for example, were now coded as having another condition known as hypercoagulable state, which was technically accurate, but did not change patients' care in any way. It did, however, generate higher payments for Medicare. Ask not what your insurer can do for you, ask how much revenue you can generate for your insurer. The insurance companies in Medicare Advantage tend to argue that they're simply recording diagnoses, not making them up, that they offer vision and dental benefits that traditional Medicare does not offer, and that they rein in unnecessary care, such as by requiring prior authorization for certain tests and procedures. But according to the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, a nonpartisan agency that counsels Congress, private Medicare Advantage plans will cost the federal government $80 billion more per year than if those patients had been in the traditional Medicare program. "You might as well flush most of that $80 billion down the toilet," Berwick told me. On December 4th, after I drafted this piece, Brian Thompson, the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, was fatally shot in Midtown Manhattan. In the days that followed, the public response was not just one of shock, but also of frustration and even rage against the health insurance industry. Someone posted in a subreddit for nurses, "Honestly, I'm not wishing anyone harm, but when you've spent so much time and made so much money by increasing the suffering of the humanity around you, it is hard for me to summon empathy that you died." The comedian Bill Burr compared CEOs like Thompson to gangsters. "It's a dirty game," he said. "Healthcare, dirty game." I was saddened by the callousness of these comments. Thompson had become a symbol of a broken system. People who devalued his life, it seemed to me, were engaging in a version of the dehumanizing behavior that they found objectionable within the healthcare industry. A few years ago, I cared for a woman I'll call Sally. About a week before I met her, Sally began to feel a soreness in her belly. As her symptoms progressed, she became fatigued and developed a burning sensation when she peed. She considered going to an urgent care clinic or an emergency room, but concerned about the expense, she decided to stay home. Sally's employer, a nearby nonprofit hospital, had recently tightened its insurance offerings, and she was now in a high deductible plan, meaning that she would be expected to cover much of the initial cost of the care that she received. Many health workers are no longer able to afford care from the very institutions that they work for. By the time I saw Sally, she was feverish and shaking with chills. A urinary tract infection that might have been quelled with a few pills had spread to her bloodstream. Her heart raced. Her blood pressure fell. It took more than a week for her to recover. It would be nice if nonprofit healthcare were the antidote to corporate healthcare. Instead, each year, it seems to look more like for-profit medicine. The Times recently reported that Providence, one of the nation's largest not-for-profit healthcare organizations, sicked debt collectors on poor patients who were entitled for free care. Providence, which was founded in the 1850s by nuns committed to serving all, especially those who are poor and vulnerable, recorded annual revenues in excess of $27 billion in 2021. Like other nonprofits, it benefited from enormous tax breaks, yet only 1% of its expenses went to charity care. Allina Health, a nonprofit based in Minnesota, denied care to patients, including children, with unpaid bills, placing them in a kind of medical debtor's purgatory. Both systems said that they would discontinue these practices after these stories broke. But other hospitals still have policies of suing patients, obtaining court orders to garnish their wages if they fail to pay, and even placing liens on their homes. Meanwhile, an increasingly consolidated healthcare industry has engendered the kinds of too-big-to-fail behemoths that can single-handedly paralyze the system. Healthcare accounts for more than 17% of the U.S. economy, or around $4.5 trillion, but the revenues of just two companies, CVS, Aetna, and United Health, account for nearly one in every $7 the nation spends on healthcare. In February, a ransomware group called Black Cat executed a cyber attack on Change Healthcare, a clearinghouse for medical claims that enables payments to doctors, hospitals, and pharmacies. The company was acquired by United Health in 2022 over antitrust objections from the Department of Justice and became embedded in nearly every part of the health system. The cyber attack compromised the medical records of around 100 million patients and profoundly disrupted the flow of data and payment. Patients could not get their medications covered. Doctors struggled to get treatments authorized. Medical clinics, unable to meet payroll, were pushed to the brink of insolvency. In the end, United Health paid a Bitcoin ransom worth some $22 million, and the system lurched back online. Data is the oil for the healthcare system, Brown, the public health professor, told me. She recalled another major ransomware attack that targeted the Colonial Pipeline, which carries gasoline from Texas to the southern and eastern United States. Data is the raw material, the critical infrastructure that facilitates the flow of money. If you control the data, you get to say how sick patients are. You get to say how well you're caring for them. You get to control the money. When I was in medical school, a mentor of mine, Mark Mercurio, told me a story from his own medical training. One evening, after midnight, a neurologist paged him and asked him to help check on an older patient who'd been unconscious for a few days. Reluctantly, Mercurio made his way from his call room, where he'd settled in for a nap, to the patient's room. There, he found the neurologist gently tapping a reflex hammer on the patient's forearms and knees, carefully recording any change from the previous night. Mercurio suggested that the neurologist speed up. It did not seem much could be gained by examining a man whose condition hadn't changed from the night before. But the neurologist proceeded, exposing as little of the patient's body as possible, determined to preserve the patient's dignity. After he finished, he tucked the blanket neatly under the man's neck. Mercurio remembered the moment as simple but astonishing. The patient had suffered a devastating brain injury. He was unlikely to recover consciousness. Yet, in the middle of the night, without any thought of insurance payments or performance reviews, a physician had given the kind of care and attention that we all hope our loved ones will receive. One of the things I love most about medicine is its peculiar professional ethic, a norm taken as given that physicians will provide counsel and care independent of self-interest and treat patients equally, regardless of their biography, condition, or ability to pay. It is because doctors are understood to place patients' interests above commercial ones that they have long enjoyed professional autonomy and public trust. The history of medicine is too littered with incompetence and immorality to believe that doctors have always been worthy of this status. Still, something profound is lost when we submit to the jaundiced view that medicine is a business like any other. There is value in striving for something higher. Today, medicine is awash in the language of economics. Patients are consumers, doctors are providers, healthcare is a commodity. Now that all bets are off and everything is getting corporatized, we are realizing how much work the professional ethos was doing to protect patients, Brown told me. It's not that any talk of money should be rejected. Hospitals and clinics need to keep the lights on, after all. But we need counter-narratives to revive medicine's social contract and to help curb the kind of financial gamesmanship that has become accepted and pervasive. I do not drag my ass out of bed at 2 a.m. for consumers with no money, Mercurio told me. For a patient with no money, I do it all the time. There have been hints of an ebb in the tide of corporatization. Lawmakers appear increasingly concerned about unwarranted payments to Medicare Advantage insurers and are trying to curb excessive patient diagnoses. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, the epicenter of the Steward health care debacle, along with Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, has proposed legislation that would require more scrutiny of private equity in health care and would penalize firms that engage in understaffing or price gouging. Some states are trying to revive dormant corporate practice of medicine laws intended to limit unlicensed for-profit entities from owning healthcare organizations or delivering medical care. Meanwhile, federal antitrust agencies have suggested that they plan to take a more aggressive approach toward anti-competitive behavior, and doctors around the country are unionizing at unprecedented rates. In June, the American Medical Association adopted a resolution on physician unionization, citing corporate dominance in healthcare and a growing moral injury related to an incongruence between what physicians care about and what they are incentivized to do by the healthcare system. A few weeks ago, I reached out to Walter J. O'Donnell, a pulmonary and critical care physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, where I completed my medical training. O'Donnell, or W.O.D., as trainees like to call him, was the type of doctor I aspired to be. He was kind, attentive, devoted, and generous with his time and expertise. In residency, there were intimidating senior physicians whom I'd hesitate to page if a patient was having a heart attack. I felt that I could text O'Donnell at midnight about someone's ingrown toenail. O'Donnell told me about a middle-aged man he cared for a couple of years ago. The patient, a long-time smoker, had been admitted to the hospital with worsening emphysema and debilitating leg pain owing to a narrowing of the arteries in his thighs. When O'Donnell discharged him, the man was to be automatically enrolled in a hospital-run smoking cessation program and also agreed to undergo a surgery to open up the vessels in his legs. A few weeks later, O'Donnell received an urgent page. The man had started smoking again and was desperately short of breath. He had tried to get help with quitting, O'Donnell told me, but the hospital's smoking cessation program had quietly been discontinued. The man's emphysema progressed, which prevented him from getting the surgery. This past year, he died. O'Donnell's story reminded me of the insidious way in which an organization's culture and purpose can shift. Although the hospital's smoking cessation program was highly successful, with quit rates approaching 70%, there is never a guarantee that it will save the life of a particular patient or generate much revenue. That is precisely why administrators could cut it. Over time, the deprioritization of less profitable services, addiction medicine consults, for instance, or labor and delivery care, in favor of more lucrative ones, can render the mission of medical care unrecognizable. Lately, O'Donnell has become more outspoken about the utter dominance of business value in healthcare. He recently convened a conference on what he calls administrative harm, the damage inflicted by administrators who increasingly make the most consequential decisions, often unilaterally, about who and what gets prioritized in a medical system. Even a few years ago, you would stop by the cafeteria and bump into an administrator, O'Donnell said. You could feel that they were accountable to you. They had this sense that, well, I could cut this program, but I know I'm going to see the head of surgery in the hallway, so I'd better have a good answer for him. But a recent study of 15 leading academic medical centers found that nearly half of their board members worked in finance, and only 15% were medical professionals. According to KFF Health News, not a single nun serves in a top role at the nation's more than 600 Catholic hospitals. Sister Jenna Rose Gervais, a longtime administrator of the Mayo Clinic, is often quoted as saying, "No money, no mission." A hospital cannot care for patients if it cannot pay for itself. But O'Donnell told me, people forget the second half of what she said. No mission, no need for money. And now from the December 9th, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, a poem, The Sterling Silver Mirror by Nikki Giovanni. No matter how the wind and the stars carried the news, the slaves knew Sherman was coming. All they had to do was wait. As they sang the spiritual, "Why can't I wait on the Lord?" They had the patience to know he may not come when you call him, but he always comes on time. My great-grandmother was a slave holding inside her the first of our family to be born free. Sherman came burning the hate and greed, freeing my ancestors. My great-great-grandmother, who had never seen her own face, carried her free baby and a sterling silver hand mirror away. Cornelia, whom we called Mama Dear, was the first to be born free. Mama Deer married Watson and birthed three sons and a daughter. Mama Deer gave her youngest son the sterling silver mirror when he graduated from Fisk University. We forget the enslaved had no way of knowing what they looked like except through the eyes of those who loved them. The men had no shoes to wear other than their feet became leather. Both were precious. Grandpapa had shoes and the mirror. Some in the family say the mirror was stolen, but how can you steal when you were? When I left my parents' home, I was the youngest daughter. I took only two things, a diamond pendant Sister Althea gave me for eighth grade graduation, and the sterling silver hand mirror. I am 81 years old. I have both still. And from the December 30th, 2024 issue, Prelude in Gray Major by Christian Wyman. Melancholy, most beautiful word, like a sound some ancient instrument unearthed or earthed its fusion of cave and cloud. Or cloud, come to think so close to could, how the mouth rounds, sounds, not just the shape itself, but a sky in which to float. Gentle hills, a home in the distance, then a whole fall filled with cool sun and shuttered colors through which one's walking, considering the long and polar O of alone, which has its own beauty, and a silent one, hiding like the seal I saw in the Strait of San Juan when the pod of killer whales glided past the rocks. Another life, as they say, though there is always only one, sound and mind so mysteriously aligned, one strains to tell if memory's foghorn is real or if that's simply the sound that memory makes. I was not alone, that much I know. Though no one was with me, gentle swells, mist tearing and repairing, and all the fine gradations of grays, like melancholy made visible, holding its holy like a secret for the end. We've run out of time for today's issue of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.